This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear several excerpts from the recent June 13th memorial honoring our own Michael Ratner.
You'll hear talks from his friends, comrades, and family.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, June 13th marked what would have been Michael Ratner's 73rd birthday. On that date this year, you, along with 900 others, and I were at Cooper Union to honor the memory of Michael.
Michael was a co-host with Heidi Boghossian and me, Michael Smith, on Law and Disorder Radio for 11 years. It was the three of us that founded it. We think it's appropriate to use this program to broadcast some of what we've recorded from the memorial on June 13th. We're going to play you short talks from Michael's younger brother, Bruce Ratner, Margaret Kunstler, Julian Assange, Wolfgang Kalick, Lizzie Ratner, Rebbe Ratner, Anna Ratner, Jake Ratner, and Michael's longtime comrade, companion, and wife, Karen Renucci, and then ending up with Michael's favorite song, The Internationale.
It was a beautiful event, inspiring, positive, joyful, and we hope that you'll enjoy listening to these excerpts. Let's take a listen.
So, of course, my name is Bruce, and Michael was my big brother. So many of you knew Michael, just as you saw him or heard me speak about what he would have done as an activist, as a human rights lawyer, and as a defender of the powerless. But before he became all of that, he was a brother. And tonight, Ellen and I are going to talk about Michael Ratner as a brother. So Michael was born on June 13, 1943. Today, he would have celebrated his 73rd birthday. I was born 18 months after Michael, and for most of our childhood, it was, as you could see by those movies, as if we were twins. In our old family photos and movies, Michael and I are always together. We're dressed the same. If you notice, I follow his every single movement. We're riding tricycles together. We're splashing each other in a toddler pool, and we're even filling up Wise potato chip cans with snails. Our father, Harry Ratner, emigrated from Białystok, Poland in 1920, escaping the persecution that was so prevalent and a regular part of life for Jews in Poland at that time. He was Yiddish-speaking, and he only had a fourth-grade education, yet he managed to start a successful building supply company in his hometown, or adopted hometown, of Cleveland, Ohio. My mother also came from, her family also came from Poland. She was the 11th of 12 children. She grew up in abject poverty during the Depression in Cleveland, Ohio. And she had a high school education. She could not afford to go to college. It cost $50. And she became a secretary. But our parents were deeply rooted in Eastern Europe. And the Holocaust was a horrible thing for them. They were shaken, and they lost many, many relatives. So probably partly because of that and because of the kind of people they were, after the war, our parents sponsored hundreds and hundreds of Jewish refugees so that they could make their way from displaced person camps to Cleveland, Ohio, where they could start a new life. As young boys, Michael and I would go with my mother, and she would locate apartments for these refugees. And on Shabbos Eve, she would bring challahs and food for them to celebrate the Shabbos as they started their new lives in America. When we spent time in my father's office, we would see men with numbers tattooed on their arms. And those people were people, men that my father had hired, so that they could, too, could start new lives in this country. But the struggle for social justice was the constant theme in our family, and particularly for our parents. Events like the Army McCarthy hearings, were listened to intensely by my father and explained to us. My mother explained to us about Brown versus the Board of Education. And those are what I would call today teachable moments at our family dinner table. In a draft of his memoir, Michael wrote, "I never forgot my father's absolute commitment to immigrants and the poor." Absolute commitment. Michael associated those words with my father, and yet we associate those words with Michael. Absolute commitment. When Michael was 8 and I was 6, along came our sister. She was adorable and cute, you can see from those movies, and she was the apple of my father's eye. Well, she took my room, and Michael and I started living together in the same bedroom. I think about it, and in many ways, I would say those were some of the happiest years of my life. At night, we would talk endlessly, and we would listen to the radio, the Cleveland Indians baseball games, which, of course, in those days, for those who don't know, in the 50s, they were quite a good team. We would talk endlessly, as I said, but every night we went through a very important ritual. He would say, "Good night, Bruce." And I would say, "Good night, Michael." When describing our family in his memoir, Michael used the name "impossibly close," or the phrase "impossibly close." Yet I know that this closeness was possible because I lived with it for 71 years. He was my hero. Words cannot capture the pride I had in him when in junior high school, he was the star of our football team. True. And believe it or not, he scored touchdown after touchdown after touchdown as the running back. Literally every time they gave him the ball, he scored. But the pride extended to when we went to law school together and he finished at the very top of our class. Or in 2001, in November, he came to me and he said, "I'm going to start a case." That case is now known as the Guantanamo case. And you have to understand, it was in the midst of the post 9/11 intense hysteria. Or when he was sick with his illness, he struggled day in and day out to get better, and he never, ever complained. But he wasn't just my hero, he was also my greatest friend. My father had a saying on the wall in his office, and it said, "A friend is one who knows all about you and loves you just the same." And that friend was Michael. He knew all about me, and he loved me just the same. Well, I followed him to Massachusetts to go to college, and then I followed him to New York to go to law school. And even into our 70s, Michael and I would get together very often. On a Sunday afternoon, I would drive up to his country house. And we would play just like we were kids together, and we would talk about politics, we'd talk about the world, we'd talk about our work, we would go fishing together, we'd talk about our parents, and most importantly, we would talk about our wonderful children. Nothing in life felt as natural to me as to be together with Michael, whether it was in our backyard in Cleveland, or upstate, or even in his hospital room. When we were together, everything seemed just right. And we knew each other inside and out. He knew at a ball game to get me 2 hot dogs with mustard, and I knew how he liked his bagel smeared with cream cheese. And he knew what to say to my kids when I could not find the words. And I knew that in his final days, Michael had one regret, and that's that he wouldn't be there to see his children, Jake and Anna, take the next steps in their adult life. Well, it's been a few weeks since we lost Michael, and spending the rest of my life without him seems like an impossibility. But Michael would not stand for such talk. He would be impatient with it. So like all of us, I will wipe away the tears, and I will keep moving forward. Always remembering how blessed I was to have Michael Ratner as my brother, and always keeping my loved ones impossibly close. Good night, Michael.
Good evening. I'm Ellen Ratner, and before I go into my talk about my brother Michael, I just want to give a shout out to Simon Alberry, who went to college with Michael in 1965. I got to spend the afternoon with him. He came here from England, and it was like being with Michael, so just thank you, Simon. You know, my brother Michael was 8 years older than me. That's a very big age gap, big enough that one might assume that Michael couldn't be bothered with me. Think about it. What would a 13-year-old boy who have any use for a kid in kindergarten? Fortunately for me, the answer to that question was Michael Ratner. Michael was the most caring, patient, and generous big brother I could have ever hoped for. My childhood memories are filled with scenes of Michael Ratner teaching me about the world and sharing knowledge, the values, and the love I needed to make my way in a very sometimes difficult life, but sometimes not. Just a few examples. I loved tagging along to watch Michael play ice hockey with his friends on a frozen pond near our house. Not only did Michael tolerate his baby sister being there, he also took that time, that rare time, to explain the science behind how water becomes ice. Michael would also play the Smothers Brothers records on hi-fi, which we now call high fidelity, explaining to me what the song lyrics meant and why these songs weren't just funny, but important. I was then beginning junior high school when Michael taught me what socialism was. And he said why it was a good thing. All people want to eat, he said. But what about the evils of communism and the domino theory that my teachers had taught me? Michael presented me with a very different view. What the United States government really wants to do is to push our system onto others, he said. Whoa. The idea that my teachers might have it wrong was mind-blowing. This was my first real lesson in critical thinking, and the first that many Michael would teach me. To be clear, Michael's socialist leanings had their limits. After all, what true socialist would invest hours teaching his little sister how to play Monopoly? And Michael didn't just teach me how to play Monopoly, he taught me how to win. He showed me which properties were the most valuable, made sure I understood the importance of building on those properties, and I think Bruce must have been taking careful notes at that time. Just a few years after my lesson in socialism, Michael told me, and I said this at his 70th birthday party, all governments are bad and some are worse than others. He said our leaders and teachers weren't telling us the truth about the war in Vietnam. He explained that millions of people in our own country didn't enjoy the same rights as perhaps he did. I wanted to believe that my teachers were right and our government was good, but somehow I knew Michael was telling me the whole truth. After all, he read absolutely everything. He seemed to know everything. He could always keep up with my parents during our dinner table conversations. He must be right, I thought. In so many ways, over so many years, on so many issues, Michael Ratner was right. He made the world a fairer, compassionate place. Today is also his birthday. He touched the minds, hearts, and lives of thousands of people in countries around the globe, and he made me as happy and as proud as a little sister could be. Thank you.
I'm Margaret Kunstler, and my role here tonight is to tell you how Michael became a political lawyer with the dream to change the world. When Michael arrived at Columbia Law School in the fall of 1966, it was his final wrenching escape from the tremendous pressure he was under to remain in Cleveland and take over the family business. Michael's loving, powerful, and generous father had died just before he went away to college, and his uncles were losing patience with his avoidance of the life they expected him to leave. Michael, for his part, had no vision of practicing law, but because he had rebelled, he needed to prove that going to law school was the right decision. He did it by excelling. He made law review and was one of the top five students in his first year class. But at the start of his second year, he saw that although his success freed him from Cleveland, it did not give him a reason to become a lawyer. He decided to leave and explained that he needed to take a year off. But I think he was at a crossroads. Maybe he wasn't going to come back. Maybe he wasn't going to be a lawyer after all. A professor suggested that he take a job with the Legal Defense Fund, no doubt hoping that Michael would find something meaningful in the practice of law that would cause him to return. LDF dispatched Michael to Baltimore to interview potential plaintiffs for a school desegregation case. On April 4, 1968, when Martin Luther King was murdered and anger, sadness, and chaos took over, LDF called him back to New York. But for 4 days, as Baltimore erupted, Michael was a prisoner, confined to a solitary motel room. It was a very desperate time, and it pained him to the bone. King was dead. Mass demonstrations against the war were having no effect. And in Orangeburg, South Carolina, students participating in a sit-in against segregation had been shot by police. Michael's return to LDF in New York coincided with the Columbia University protest. The opportunity to join the movement was waiting for him. Striking students occupied campus buildings after the university refused to end its support of the Vietnam War and its plan to build a gym facility in Harlem's Morningside Park. On the night of April 24th, when baton-wielding police arrived on campus to forcibly remove the students, Michael was standing on College Walk. He was shocked and angered that the university would make such a move. As the police marched through the gates in military formation, Michael had a choice. He could disappear into the milling crowd around the edges or join the line of people standing in front of Lowe Library to protect the occupiers. Scared to death, he linked arms with the other protesters singing, "We Shall Overcome." Michael was thrown to the ground and beaten by a baton-wielding cop. That night, 150 students were sent to the hospital and 700 people were arrested. Michael, his body bruised, his voice hoarse from screaming, had made an ultimate decision and would never turn back. He had joined the struggle to make a better world. That spring, he found his path, a way to link law with activism. Working with law school friends, Eleanor Stein, Gus Reichbach, others, and me, and mentored by lawyers from the CCR, Morty Stavis, Arthur Kanoy, Bill Kunstler, and from the Guild, Mary Kaufman, the Lubell brothers, Bill Schapp, and many others, he learned very quickly how law could be used as a political tool. The suit he helped bring on behalf of the striking students against the trustees was a political document setting forth the university's collaboration in the war effort and its racist effort to build a gym. It didn't matter that there was no chance it could win. It was a document that served the political aspirations of the protesters. He returned to law school, his life as an activist lawyer, involved with the hopes and aspirations of his clients, had begun.
Michael and CCR represented hundreds of people and organizations against government surveillance, the infiltration of peace groups, and the targeting of protesters and whistleblowers. So it was only natural when Chelsea Manning leaked thousands of secret documents, Michael reached out to WikiLeaks, which published them for the world to see. Michael represented WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who this week will mark his fourth anniversary holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Michael would spend so many long hours, days at a time, with Assange and the embassy working on his case. Ecuador has granted Julian Assange political asylum, but he fears if he steps outside, he could ultimately be extradited to the United States and could face life in prison. Michael agreed and never stopped defending Julian Assange.
Michael started out his law career essentially as a liberal, believing in the rule of law and believing that the law was a means to obtain justice on average. By the end of the 1960s, through experience in trying to apply the law to defend people, he had come to understand something that I've come to understand, which is the application of the law is primarily designed to ensure that existing power inequalities are reinforced. That is to keep private property in the hands of the wealthy and keep certain privileges which are accumulated by establishments in their hands. And that is the primary purpose of law and the primary purpose of the judicial system. But that nonetheless, one can hack the judicial system to do something it was not designed to do, which is to achieve justice. And he was a great and effective campaigner in doing that over many years and is a model for many young lawyers who have been inspired by him and even a model in some respects for me. He was not someone who threw his life away or burnt out too young. He lived a rich and full family life and also a rich and full intellectual life in his fight for justice. So I think we should celebrate Michael, but also learn from the very positive example that Michael has set over more than 40 years of work.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Wolfgang Kalek. I'm from Berlin. I'm heading the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, an organization co-founded by Michael. Michael was an internationalist in the best sense of the word. That meant for him, in the first place, to combat the use and the abuse of power of US actors in and very often outside the US. And there was and there is no shortage of work for him and all the others in the same struggle, many of us here today. Vietnam, Nicaragua, Haiti, and during the last 15 years, Afghanistan and Iraq. In this struggle, the two of us met, fighting against forced disappearance and torture of terrorism suspects. Together with Peter Weiss and CCR, we filed criminal complaints against Donald Rumsfeld and others in Germany 2004, 2006, and later in other European countries. And we did this against the very advice of established human rights lawyers who feared that the use of universal jurisdiction laws against these powerful actors would result in a terrible defeat and a backlash of the law. Michael always had a very relaxed response to that. If these laws cannot be applied against the powerful, what are they made for? Moreover, it was one thing to challenge US actions in the US, but it needs even more courage to file a criminal complaint against a ruling secretary before a foreign court. With his willingness to challenge power and to take risk, Michael was a big step ahead of other actors within the US, but also the international human rights and legal community. Michael's place was the world. But not only as a forum to struggle or to file lawsuits. No, he was genuinely interested in the places he visited and the people he met. His fighting spirit, his experience, his personality were crucial when we decided to establish the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights back in 2007. And he was present, and I mean present in the very sense of the word, from the first moment when we founded the organization during the critical first years, until last summer, he never missed a single session of our board, which he shared. But he was never, ever one of these leftist ego star lawyers. Instead, he was always willing to share his experience, open and honest, never claiming a special role for himself. And he had this kind of revolutionary patience and modesty. and it's fair to say that we could learn a lot from him in this regard. He was a one-man force multiplier, as David Colt described him, and he mobilized and inspired younger and older lawyers, not only in the US, but also in Europe, just to give you two examples. Paolo Caroli, a 20-something ECCHR alumnus, wrote the first obituary to Michael in an Italian newspaper, Dalle Pantere Nere a Guantanamo, from the Panthers to Guantanamo. And our advisory board member, Anne Michaus, accomplished one of the most remarkable tributes to him so far. In the Free University of Brussels, they named an auditorium after him 2 weeks ago. Our transnational community of radical political lawyers has lost one of its most central characters. But I lost more. I lost a great friend. In my last encounter with him, he told me that he had always loved to come to Berlin, but he did not talk about litigation and the more or less exciting meetings of our board. He meant the parties and exhibitions at our office. We will miss him. Thank you.
Wow. I'm Lizzie Ratner, and I'm one of the two people lucky enough in this world to call Michael my uncle. 2 years ago in May, Michael sent out an email to our family, one of those regular messages our semi-nuclear crew often got from him. Remarkable day, extremely moving and interesting, his email began. We walked to the gravesite. It's in a part of the cemetery where they buried the first set of concentration camp victims. Elias Spett, our great uncle, was one of these. Elias Spett. We had only learned of him a few months before, but Michael had become fascinated by him in the way that only Michael could. Michael visited the home in Berlin where Elias Spett lived before he was taken by the Nazis to Sachsenhausen, the concentration camp. Michael visited Sachsenhausen. He visited the cemetery. And then he visited a stonemason to order a new gravestone to replace the existing badly weathered one. Michael also ordered two Stolperstein, or memorial blocks, to be placed in front of his house where Elias and his wife Emma had lived before the Nazis killed them. Michael had a habit of going deep, following the trail of his preoccupations all the way to their fascinating conclusion. Still, I wondered about the intensity of this one, about Michael's commitment to affirming the life of a man he had never met. It's true, I think, that the Holocaust glowed like a kind of microwave background in his life, reflecting back his earliest consciousness of the human ability to do terrible things to other people. And Elias Spett's story was certainly a burning example of that. But was that it? Was it also that the two men were linked by a shared birthday, today, June 13th? That Michael was himself newly a great uncle to a boy who by pure happenstance was named Elias. Or was it all this and something else as well? When Michael's daughter Anna was bat mitzvahed years ago, she began her speech with one of my favorite opening lines of all time. I don't believe in God, but I believe in family. We all loved that line, Michael most of all, I think. The boldness, the whiff of rebellion, the way it captured our fierce devotion to each other. But recently, I've begun to think it captured something else as well. While it's true that my family is, for the most part, a secular bunch, people of the here and now, that hasn't stopped us from practicing what I can only describe as a kind of ancestor worship. We revere our ancestors, hallow them, aware that but for them, we would not be here. And but for them, in some physical and even metaphysical way, we would not be who we are. Our most intense worship has always been reserved for Michael's parents, Harry and Anne, who died young but loomed enormous over our lives, like two powerful, if imperfect, and very short deities. Gods of generosity, humanism, irreverence, and wit. But it wasn't just them. Great-grandparents, great-aunts and uncles, Elias Spett. Their stories became our stories, founding myths for us to draw on, learn from, and live up to. Michael is one of the ancestors now, a member of the pantheon of those who came before. In life, he was my political sage, mentor, cheerleader, and a person I simply adored. In death, he is my guide and example, at once absent and more consciously present, challenging me to be bold when I want to play it safe, reminding me to seek out principle and hold fast to it, urging me to build community, be curious, be rigorous, expansive, dedicated, and always, always to go for the joke. I'm so glad you all clapped there, because that means you really knew Michael. I'm still figuring out exactly how to honor Michael, the ancestor. But several days after he died, I sat in his office with my son, the other Elias in this story, who is now six and sitting right over there, surrounded by all the artifacts of Michael's extraordinary journey. Elias said of his great uncle, "We have to tell people about Michael so they will know what he did. And then they have to tell people, who have to tell more people, who have to tell more people, who have to tell more people. And that way, what he did will go on forever." Tonight, you have heard so many remarkable stories about Michael. This is my contribution, and I hope you'll share them all. Thank you.
Next up. So I'm the other lucky half of the other niece, and for the past 44 years, Michael has been my most amazing and adored uncle. When Michael was first diagnosed last summer, it was absolutely unimaginable that we would be standing here today. A few days before the diagnosis, he'd been throwing up, so I emailed him to check in. He emails back, "It's the gift that keeps on giving. Soon you'll be able to see my six-pack." Always, his humor slayed me. Many of his jokes and gestures I carry on internal repeat, and I would add this one to my roster. Until that Saturday when my dad called and told me the news, though we didn't yet know the specifics. I was in upstate New York that weekend, and I was beached on a bed in what had years ago been the living room, Googling brain tumors and praying to the God I only believe in during horrible moments, that it would be the most benign of a not very benign physiological event. I knew how lucky we had been to have everyone in my immediate and immediate extended family still around, with the painful exception of my mother's sister, and I had hoped we could keep kicking the can of inevitable loss down the road. Anyway, there I am on this bed, marveling at the irony of how one of my fonder recent memories had played out on this very spot a few years back. We're all upstate, and my dad and Michael, two grown men in their late 60s, are lying on this bed side by side, like some prepubescent kids passing a phone back and forth. "Emzo," that's what we call Michael. "Look at this." "No," Michael would say, incredulous and his hands smacking against his mouth. "Bezo, that's unbelievable." I imagine this might not have been so different from how they rolled back in their childhood when sharing a bedroom. I was being given a window into that elusive thing we don't usually get to witness of our parents, but I got to witness often as I watched all of my father's and his brother and sister's relationships unfold very regularly. So I was being given a window into their childhood. I took a break from my frantic Googling. I wander into the kitchen and the table's still cluttered with a recent meal, and that table too holds a specter of a recent memory that is simple but adored. We're eating a meal which is considered, which consists of foods that serve, according to Michael, in the highest manner as vehicles for ketchup. He does, it's true. It's incredible to behold. Karen is sitting between Michael and my dad. Emzo, this is my dad, pass the ketchup. And then a minute later, Bruce, could you hand me the ketchup? This goes on for about half the meal with Karen transferring the ketchup back and forth. And then finally, Karen says, could you two just like sit next to each other? I've been spending the whole meal passing the ketchup between you both. All right. So I know these are seemingly small and insignificant events, but they are also ones of deep familiarity and intimacy. They happen and they get appreciated when you know someone so well that their movements, words, and actions speak to a level of comfort so wide and so deep that if you're lucky enough, you catch their specialness in the moment, you hold on to it, you marvel at the mastery of love playing out in its most quotidian of ways. With Michael around, just as with my dad, I felt more at home. Michael didn't have kids until I was 16. Thank God he met Karen and they gave me the absolute best cousins in the world, but for the first 16 years, he was the other significant surrogate parent figure in my life, except that he didn't yell at me. It's true. I love you, but it happens. It happens. It's how you discipline, how you teach a kid. Anyway, okay. It's not fun. Not fun. Okay. So it's Michael. So as Michael, surrogate of mine, it was he whose counsel I ended up seeking for my own world events, albeit of a more internal and less newsworthy nature than the ones he grappled with in his work. It is Michael whose existential considerations I sought when struggling with interpersonal issues, romantic, work, or otherwise. And it is Michael who I called when my dad and I had a potentially serious rift and I needed his opinion on how to proceed. There are any number of reasons I sought Michael out, but at base, I think it's because he spoke from a place of being able to deeply understand the experience of the other person. Michael was a master at relationships. Many people are here tonight because of Michael's fierce commitment to fighting for human dignity against systemic odds. But I don't think he would have been so effective had one fundamental element not been in consistent play underneath it all. At very least for me, but I imagine for many. And we've heard this. And that fundamental element, perhaps a part of the impossibly close, is love.
Hello, I'm Anna. I'm Michael's daughter. And I want to start just by thanking my mom, who has been staying up night after night. So that all of us could be here. And this is incredible, incredibly meaningful for all of us. So thank you, Mom. I've been looking back at notes I wrote throughout the last 9 months while my dad was sick. There's one called Things to Remember About This Time. I wrote it at a point when Michael was so sick he could barely stand up from his chair. The first part of the note describes a week where I had a bad cold, and every time my dad saw me, he would say, "Poor Anna, I hate seeing you feeling bad." He would go on to say just how the energy that Jake and I had made him so happy, that us being in the room with him made him feel better. I know that his extreme empathy, which often made it hard for him to sit through certain sad movies, played a huge part in the work that he dedicated his life to. Many people tonight talked about Michael as a lawyer and an activist. But of course, I want to talk about Michael as our dad. I think about the work he was doing my whole life, its global impact and importance to so many movements and individuals. Then I think about the family dinners that Jake and I were forced to attend every single night at 5 o'clock. It makes me wonder if there were maybe two Michaels. One who was in Cuba talking with Haitian refugees detained at Guantanamo, and one who spent every night reading books to me about animal emotions or benevolent witches while we ate bags and bags of salt and vinegar potato chips. Past 9 months, we've also been watching a lot of our home movies, which we're all incredibly lucky to have a journalist for a mother because every moment was documented. And the one thing that comes across more than anything is that as a family, we were constantly playing. Michael would throw us over his head into the air, all of us yelling until we were exhausted. We would dress up for our Gloria Estefan family dance parties in red capes, which on their off time were velvet banners embroidered with Lenin's face that hung above our dining room table. Jake would hold a scepter, which doubled as a caraca given to Michael from Coroma, Bolivia, to thank him for returning sacred textiles. As we got older, our relationships changed, and we all had to learn what it meant to be in a family of adult children with adult parents. My dad and I would talk about this, about how he never felt like he had this opportunity, since both his parents had died when he was young. He was nervous that he didn't know how to do it, to be the father of grown children, but he definitely did. We talked about everything. He would make fun of me for drinking kombucha and always dating musicians. We would talk about the deer and bear he caught on his critter cam that he tied to trees in the woods upstate. It was always the first thing he would do when we got up there is run into the woods and untie the camera from the tree, run home, plug the chip in, and then go through the probably thousands of photos, some mostly leaves falling. Sometimes there'd be like a squirrel and he would make sure to email it to every single person in our family. And we would talk about, he helped me with my applications to grad school down to every last detail, going with me to London to my interview, edit all my papers. And then of course, what types of activism would best bring on the revolution. And of course, he was still my dad, but he also became my best friend. At his 70th birthday party, I read a speech to him that included a part about an avocado pit that Jake, him, and I had planted 19 years ago, when I was 7 and Jake was 9. The pit is now a full-size tree. It's about 6 feet tall and lives at our home in Greenwich Village. It spends summers in the backyard and then comes inside for the winter. After Michael got sick, he spent most of the day sitting in the living room where the avocado tree was overwintering. Often when we were talking, our conversation would turn to our shared concern for the health of this tree. Thinking about it now, his concern was in part concern for me and mine for him. The tree's leaves were drying and falling off. It really didn't look good. One day, in desperation, Michael ordered a sun lamp in order to revive it. When the light arrived, I installed it while he directed me from his chair. Every morning, when he came upstairs, the first thing he did before he sat down was walk over to the tree and turn the sun lamp on. We thrived under his care, and we both became optimistic. The tree had returned to health. I think about this tree as something we shared from my childhood until the day he died. It's a symbol of the love he had for us, as well as his excitement for life and all living things, down to the smallest fish. The day before his final hospitalization, the tree was moved to the backyard, and the sun lamp stayed in the living room, shining brightly on a papier-mâché cactus. The last thing that I heard him say before he died was a classic Michael Ratner joke that made fun of all of us for trying to grow this inanimate object. When I remember him, of course, I remember his incredible legacy that will live on in all of us. But I also remember that as important as his work was, he put Jake, Elena, Karen, Lizzie, Alan, and me before all of it. And that is what made him so special. It is easy for one to become overwhelmed by the state of this world, especially as an activist fighting every day to change it. But if there is one thing that Michael can teach all of us, it is that the most important thing you can do in this world is be the fans you love.
So growing up with Michael and Karen as parents was joyful, it was affirming, it was loving, but it was also unique. On the day I was born, as all the other babies were being wrapped in pink and blue blankets, my dad swaddled me in a blanket with big block letters across it that said, "The People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola." It's true. Then next to me, he placed a copy of Eduardo Galeano's book, Memory of Fire, and he snapped my first baby photo. This was gonna be a different kind of childhood. By age 5, I would often climb up on the back of the chair and take down a wooden gun from the shelf that had FMLN painted on it, the Salvadoran Revolutionary Guerrilla Movement, for those that didn't laugh. And I would parade around the dining room in my pajamas. On birthdays, we would take down a Palestinian keffiyeh from the coat rack, and I would wrap it around my eyes, and we would take turns wailing at a piñata. Around the holidays, the mantelpiece in our living room became a tapestry of taped-up holiday cards, just beneath the Emmy my mom won for a documentary about hard metals disease. And I seemed to be constantly getting passed between revolutionary leaders and political icons, somehow winding up in the arms of President Aristide from Haiti, or Daniel Ortega, or sitting on the knee of Muhammad Ali. But honestly, that was all just the backdrop. The real memories I have are the hours upon hours that my parents played with us. For as much as my dad spent working furiously, he dedicated his life to us even more, if that's possible. He would take us on long walks through the woods, or hatch baby ducks in our city bathtub, or dig for ancient treasures in abandoned house foundations in upstate New York. It was all just at the same time with the chitter-chatter of grown-ups talking about the history of freedom struggles from around the world. Just even tonight, I was talking to someone, and they told me a story about when they were working together on Haiti, and they would hold intense meetings to decide what the next move would be. And so all seated around a conference room, I was about 3 or 4, would crawl out from underneath the table. And my dad would say, "Jakey," and stop the whole meeting and get down on the floor to play with me. By the time my dad had his own kids, he actually had a large following of youngins who would trail him wherever he went. So much so that some of them became concerned when his first kid was on the way. That's me. In his wedding speech, standing next to my very pregnant mom, my dad says, "One of the children came up here and asked me, Michael, now that you're having your own kids, will you love us any less? And so I just want to say to all of the children here that I love each and every one of you very much, and no, I will never love you any less." He had a natural gift for connecting with young people, an ability to share in their curiosity of the world, spouting off facts on any topic they threw his way, and a silliness and a joyfulness that endeared them. Ask any kid here under the age of 12 what my dad's real name is, and they'll tell you,
Mr. Cool!
Mr. Cool. And yet, he would also take them seriously. He would ask about what was happening in their lives, ask their thoughts about the state of the world, and listen deeply to all they had to say. So I think between this profound humility and his dedication to us, it wasn't until I was a lot older that I began to realize who my dad really was. One day, on the way home from school at age 13, I walked by a yellow New York Post news box, and there, pushed up against the glass, was the front page with a photo of my dad. And in big, bold letters across the top, the headline read, "Lawyer for Terror." So I promptly took it home and pinned it up against my above my bed and displayed it to all my very confused friends. When I was 14, I heard there was going to be a student walkout to join a major march against the Iraq War in Union Square. Probably more interested in a good excuse to skip out, I convinced a few friends to go with me and head to the march. And there, to my shock, was my dad. On stage and speaking to a crowd of thousands with an intense passion and a righteous anger that I had never seen before at the unjust killing of so many, justified with a manufactured fear. And to this day, I feel like I'm still finding out who he was. When I got the news that my dad was sick, I took the next flight to New York, and I moved back into my parents' home. My sister moved in too. It was the first time in a decade that we were all back together under the same roof. The house just teemed with life, all of our normal rhythms suspended so that we could spend every day together. And while there were so many moments when we were drained and my dad was beyond exhausted, every time my sister and I would come into the room, he would rouse and a huge smile would light up across his face. He would ask us about our days, want to know what we were thinking about and feeling and what we thought of what was going on. We shared so many beautiful memories these last 9 months, knowing that we had to make the most of whatever time we had. I've always known that my parents were at the heart of a big, beautiful, progressive community that spanned across the country and even around the world. But seeing this community come together these last few months has been remarkable. The living room of our home became a salon where journalists and lawyers and organizers would come together, sharing stories of decades of work done in community. The doorbell seemed to be constantly ringing. One night, I heard it ring, and I groggily shuffled downstairs in my socks to open the front door. And standing there was Judge Balthazar Garzon, the Spanish judge that indicted the Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. I tried to keep his eyes up from my socks. Those months, though, they turned into an incredible history of my dad's life, with all of us perched on the couch getting to listen to story after story that he told, hanging on every word in a way we had never before. Like how he decided to go to Nicaragua and gather the testimonies from survivors of a massacre that was carried out by U.S.-supplied mercenaries. And when he arrived, he was handed a machine gun, and he was taught how to shoot it, and he was driven up into the mountains where mortar shells were exploding all around him. Or how he tracked down dozens of sacred textiles that had been stolen from a Bolivian village. And when he was finally able to get them back, he flew with the textiles to La Paz, only to step off the plane to see 30,000 people there waiting to receive them. Hearing the way he told these stories, still with so much passion, so many years later, or watching him muster all his energy to call Julian Assange on a cryptophone from his reclining chair, I'm just left with such awe as to how he was able to sustain it all these years. But he always said the key was not doing it alone. He said you need to build a community of people all around you who can share in this work together. And he did. When he got one last moment to speak to a group of movement activists and young people, he kept repeating over and over again, "I am not pessimistic at all." But it was not naivete. He knew things that were going in an increasingly terrifying direction. But he saw this community of people committed to carrying out this work. He saw young people picking up the torch. He watched as movements were on the rise. He believed they could only grow stronger. He believed they could turn the tide. And he believed in us. Thank you.
Be warned, we are at a tipping point into lawlessness and medievalism. We have our work to do. For each of us, the time for talking is long, long over. This is no time for compromise, no time for political calculation. As Howard Zinn admonishes us, it is the job of thinking people not to be on the side of the executioners.
Michael Ratner, Presidente! His spirit lives on in each of us. And as his family, we feel confident because we know this room of people, we know all the people that he's influenced, that our work is cut out. We're going to continue our struggles to save this planet and to create a just world. And so Michael will be there for us, with us, but it's up to us now. So thank you all for being here. And we want to hear from you. Many of you have been sending us photos, wonderful stories, and we've put them up on a Tumblr site. And thanks to our dear friends, Anthony Arnov, Hannah Lane, Roy Singham, and all the dear friends of ThoughtWorks who have built an archive site to Michael, where future generations will be able to know his story and to be inspired to go forward. So at this point, I want to be joined by some in this community. Come, guys. Here to go. Come on. And we want all of you to join us in Michael's favorite song. All right, where's the slide?